Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome or welcome back to Season 3 of the Logical Christian Podcast. I'm your Logical Christian, Dan Irwin. The Logical Christian Podcast is not here to tell you what to think. It's an exercise in how to think. Rather than just accept what we're being told with regard to current events, politics, science, religion, and everything else, we're going to stop the spin, ask questions, dive deep, and look at the world logically. And since logic is a gift from God, most importantly, we're going to look at it all as Christians. Links can be found in the show notes if you'd like to follow along. So with that, let's go be logical Christians. Have you ever thought that what you think or feel may not be what you think or feel, but may be thoughts or feelings imposed on you by factors outside of your control? If you've ever thought that, how can you be sure that you're thinking about that correctly? In fact, how can I be sure that the thoughts I'm speaking right now are thoughts I want to think or say? I mean, I think they are, but I guess I can only trust that to a certain degree. What do you think? On today's episode, first we're going to dive deep inside you, very deep. Oh no, deeper than that, and find or discover something. I guess. Then we'll clean that filthy brain of yours, and finally we'll discuss a few books, one of which will definitely make you think things. So many things. So, go get your blood drawn, we're gonna need a sample. Then of course you'll need to clean your hands. Cleaner than that. Even cleaner. And finally, clear some room on your reading list. Or don't, it's really kind of up in the air on this one. And now I think, although am I really thinking anything? Here we go. Wherever you go, there you are. And that simple fact, my friends, is both a function of your genes and the reason you're happy. Unless you're not happy, in which case, maybe you're not where you currently are. Or maybe your genes are messed up. Not genes like pants, genes like, you know, your genetics. Here's the thing. You're likely confused. No idea what I'm talking about. Well, join the club. I'm actually right there with you. Well, unless you aren't where you are, in which case I may be where you are or aren't, which is where I may or may not be with myself and yourself, or possibly neither of us are where we are, but at least we're together, wherever that is. Look, I think before my brain turns to liquid, let's just move into what I found on scipost.org, headline, Mindfulness in Your DNA? Capacity to be present is partly a function of genetics, study finds. Quote, people who are more present in the moment tend to be happier and more satisfied with life, and part of this connection is attributable to the genes they were born with, according to new research published in Scientific Reports. The new findings shed light on how our genetic makeup and personal experiences intertwine to influence our ability to live in the moment and our overall happiness. May I speak for both of us, please? That paragraph didn't help. Okay. Let's back up, try to define some terms, shall we? Specifically, we need to define mindfulness and the concept of being present in the moment. Then we can take a look at our genes and see what we got brewing down there. These two terms are apparently synonymous, as in being present in the moment is a core, or maybe the core, of mindfulness, and mindfulness requires one to be present in the moment. Now, I've spoken about mindfulness before, not to any great depth, but I've mentioned it in a handful of past episodes. I believe I've also mentioned the totally not Christian in any way poorly termed Christian mindfulness. Make no mistake, if someone tries to sell you on Christian mindfulness, know that by definition, that doesn't exist. So, looking at an article on psychology today, we find that, quote, mindfulness is a state of active, open attention to the present. This state is described as observing one's thoughts and feelings without judging them as good or bad. You can identify feelings, label them, but you are not to pass judgment on yourself, and no, I still don't understand it either. We soldier on. Quote, mindfulness is rooted in Buddhist and Hindu teachings. Buddhism includes a journey toward enlightenment and the concept of sati, which encompasses attention, awareness, and being present, is considered the first step toward enlightenment. Mindfulness encompasses two key ingredients, awareness and acceptance. Awareness is the knowledge and ability to focus attention on one's inner processes and experiences, such as the experience of the present moment. Acceptance is the ability to observe and accept, rather than judge or avoid, these streams of thoughts. Okay. mindfulness is also a part of meditation, or at least they're tied together also somehow, which, I mean, why wouldn't they be, right? They both come out of Eastern mysticism. Quote, mindfulness can help bring you into the present moment throughout the day. As you wake up, you can focus on your breathing and the way your body gradually becomes more energized. They've never seen me in the morning. You can incorporate a brief meditation into your work day, perhaps on your lunch break, and focus and appreciate the experience of eating during meals. I can probably get on board with the appreciating the experience of eating. It sounds fairly innocent, right? I mean, just relax and breathe and remove judgment. Just focus on right now and nothing else. Quote, mindfulness is one form of meditation. Meditation utilizes various practices to quiet the mind or achieve a higher level of consciousness, one of which is mindfulness. Mindfulness can be cultivated within or outside of formal meditation and woven into any activity, such as taking a walk or being engaged in conversation. All right, so if you dig deeper into meditation just a bit, it almost always includes chanting of a mantra or clearing your mind of all thoughts, just trying to create a blank slate, if you will, and then open yourself to, well, I guess enlightenment. Now, when you look in the Bible, meditation is mentioned 15 to 20 times or so, depending on the translation you're using. In the book of Joshua, chapter 1, we find that Yahweh is speaking with Joshua, the newly appointed leader of the Israelites, and he's told, quote, "This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it." We read in Psalms, in multiple places, that we are to meditate on God's work, on God's laws, on God's testimonies. We see a handful of other places where meditate is used in various other ways, but it's never used in a way so as to imply clearing your mind of all thoughts and focusing on your breathing. In fact, in every single instance, it's used in a way that denotes concentrated, focused thinking that's either occurring right at that time on a specific subject or has occurred in the past or a command or recommendation for something to do in the future. And while we're walking down this path, realize that nowhere in the Bible does it tell us to clear our mind and just pursue some sort of enlightenment. Let's potentially tip over a few idols at the risk of annoying some. If you have a pastor or a teacher or a friend or whoever who tells you, you know, to pray and then just sit in silence and let God speak to you, get away from that person or at the very least correct them. God does not speak to us like that at this point in human history. Now, could he? Yeah, he can do whatever he wants to, but he doesn't. If you've ever heard someone say, or you've ever said yourself, and most of us are guilty of doing this at some point, that God told you something. No, he didn't. Or at least you have no way of proving that he did. If you know God spoke to you for sure, then we need to add whatever he said to the end of the scriptures, as God speaking then and God speaking now carries the exact same weight and importance. Unfortunately, this is a practice that many otherwise solid Bible teachers subscribe to. I'd argue in many cases without realizing what they're actually saying. If you want to hear God speak, read your Bible. The very first verse in the book of Hebrews tells us, quote, God having spoken long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways in these last days spoke to us, past tense, in his Son. We're in the last days and have been since Jesus ascended back to heaven. And where do we find what the Son of God said? In the Bible. To ascribe what you think God might have said to you to God could very potentially be using God's name in vain, because attaching his name to something that he didn't say is to use his name wrongly. That was a stoning in the Old Testament. Luckily for many, many people today, that's not still the penalty. So in short, mindfulness is a practice of meditation where you clear your mind, focus on nothing but your breathing, allow thoughts to flow in and out without doing anything with them. Being present in the moment is doing that while ensuring you focus on the right now. Forget the past, ignore the future, simply focus on this breath in and then this breath out, removing thoughts from your mind, etc. Okay, back to the article. Quote, people who are more present in the moment tend to be happier and more satisfied with life, and part of this connection is attributable to the genes they were born with. So, if you're not able to meditate, not able to be present in the moment, thus not able to reach a satisfaction in life, it's your parents' fault. Their premise is that study after study proves that those able to be present in the moment are happier and more satisfied. This is now taken as simple fact. What's not understood, of course, is why. And why are some people more able to be present than others? Having exhausted the concepts of socialization from parents and teachers, formal training, etc., they decided to look deeper into our very genetic makeup. And what the study team found will shock you. Well, it probably won't. I mean, what they found is what I've actually just told you. So, I mean, maybe I should have given a spoiler alert or something. Anyway, apparently the King's College London started a database in 1994 tracking twins. They've had 15,000 families participate in this project where they collect all sorts of data on identical and fraternal twins in order to analyze development based on environment and genetics and all sorts of other factors. Interesting idea, to be honest. So this study on being present focused on twins born between 1994 and 1996 using the data that was collected in 2011 when the participants were approximately 16 years old. This resulted in 1,136 pairs of twins, both identical, who share 100% of their genetic material, and fraternal, who share about 50%. Then they, it appears, put them through a series of mindfulness tests. There was a 15-question test called the Mindful Attention Awareness Scale, or MAS, that asks if you almost always or almost never, with four options between those two extremes, and then it gives you a scenario like forgetting someone's name as soon as you're told it, or doing things on automatic like driving somewhere, or working on something while someone is talking to you. The higher the score, the less mindful you are. I scored a 4.1 on a scale of 6, so I'm somewhat mindful, I guess. They were also measured via the Subjective Happiness Scale, or SHS, and the Brief Multidimensional Student Life Satisfaction Scale, the BSMLS, which is just the worst acronym ever. I really need to do better. In order to assess their happiness and satisfaction of their lives, you know, participants. Anyway, the Subjective Happiness Scale is a simple 4-question test where you self-evaluate your happiness. I'm a moderately happy person, apparently. And the BMS-LSS seems to be a shortened version of the MS-LSS, another self-rating of happiness, although I couldn't find the exact scale. I'll assume I'm moderately satisfied with life if, you know, the other two results are to be believed. So using the TWINS database, these test results, they discovered, quote, a modest yet significant positive correlation between presence and subjective well-being. This indicates that adolescents who reported higher levels of presence also reported higher levels of happiness and life satisfaction. Furthermore, they purport to have discovered that presence and subjective well-being were significantly influenced by genetic factors. Put simply, they found that identical twins showed higher levels of presence, happiness, and life satisfaction. They further found that presence and life satisfaction seem to share genetic factors to a larger extent than life satisfaction and happiness, which I guess by deduction would show that happiness and life satisfaction don't share as many genetic factors. Apparently. They also looked at factors regarding shared experiences, shared environmental factors, and non-shared experiences with regard to presence, happiness, and life satisfaction. So boiling it all down, their conclusion, quote, the capacity to be present is partly a function of genetics and partly driven by environmental causes like training and mindfulness meditation. The genetic basis helps to explain why presence appears to support well-being. Of course, for as extensive as a study as this is, there were some caveats with the data that they needed to state. The study was based on twins, obviously. They were mostly white, about 16 years old, and all UK residents. So maybe don't go thinking you can take these results and just apply them to everybody. They're really not sure. So here's the thing. I don't really think they did a good study on genetics. They did a study on twins, on twin white kids in the UK, and even with the small population out of which the sample was pulled, they still really didn't get anything conclusive. They got data that seems to indicate or that resulted in a spurious correlation. That said, there's no question that some people are definitely born with, say, more cognitive abilities. Some are born with a more fragile mental state, just like some are born with a better immune system, etc., etc. I mean, we've known that forever. That's literally genetics, and that's literally what the eugenic and then the Nazi movement was trying to do. Breed the best genetics to create the Ubermensch, you know, the Superman. So to think that there are twins, the same genetic makeup, that are generally more satisfied in life despite the external non-shared experiences, okay, that makes sense. And that maybe non-identical twins don't work the same as identical, okay, not exactly the same genetics. I mean, I'm not sure what ground we're breaking here. But of course, that's not what's important. What's important is trying to correlate being present with being happy. Again, if you're constantly living in the past, fretting over what you said or what you did, you'd be like me, then you'd start sweating. But doing that all the time, you will not be as happy. If you're constantly looking to the future, worrying about what you'll do or who you'll run into or what to say, how to afford this or that, or what if this other thing happens, you'd be like me, and then you'd start sweating. But doing that all the time will definitely put a damper on happiness. If by being present, they mean to not worry about tomorrow because today has enough troubles of its own, yeah, I mean, I can go along with that. But that's not what they mean. What they mean is to live for this very second by clearing your mind. And if they can correlate genetics while at the same time push the thought that if you could only be present, you'd be happy. Well, then they can push the mindfulness meditation thing, and well, that's exactly what we're seeing pretty much everywhere. Have you seen the advertisement for the Calm app on TV? There are a few versions, but it's a natural landscape, something white noise-ish, and a countdown timer, and that's it. Well, that's one of the top meditation apps on the App Store. Is it okay to relax sometimes? Absolutely. I'm not a fan of the beach. However, I'm a fan of sitting on a balcony pretty high up that's facing the beach with the sliding door open and the AC blasting, just smelling the air, listening to the waves, and then after a few minutes, I'll usually grab a book, maybe take a nap. That's relaxing. My other favorite place to relax is watching airplanes take off and land. I mean, the sound, the massive size, the intricate systems, the gracefulness, like the beach, I'll just sit there and watch. But I'll be taking pictures, I'll be looking up the airport schedule, etc. I'll be reading in between planes. I won't just be staring at planes, thinking nothing, drooling on my shirt. The mindfulness and meditation thing is being pushed everywhere right now. It's being pushed at workplaces. Mandatory mindfulness breaks is being done in schools all over the country. A Christian friend of mine a few years ago, teacher, not one who is terribly knowledgeable about biblical things, not one who keeps up with the latest fads and what they're actually promoting. Well, her school was pushing the mindfulness thing in class. It's a meditation thing to try to force boys primarily to calm down and really, if we're being honest, to act more like girls, right? And it can work if you ignore the potential harm. So she brought that home to her daughter and her to do mindfulness techniques in the evening to calm down and relax their way into the evening. Well, I found out about this and told her to stop it immediately. Then I explained the dangers inherent in clearing out your mind and opening yourself to whatever. Because trust me, a whatever will answer that call. Once I explained what mindfulness really was and how it's completely contradictory to the Bible, she stopped. Well, so what about yoga, you might ask? Well, this is something I'd have to put in the category of conscience, right? In my opinion, the stretches are fine. They contort and twist and stretch the body in ways that would result in my dialing 911 if I were to try it. If you want to stretch, stretch. Some Christians would argue that even the stretching is satanic. I humbly disagree. But if you do feel that the stretching is wrong, then yes, it would be sinful for you to do it. Listen to your conscience. But the Eastern mysticism, the meditation portion of yoga, should not take place, at least not for the Christian, ever. What about Christian meditation, you may ask? No. See, I'd put that in the same category as, say, like the Enneagram. I'm going to step on toes here, probably. They're both satanic tools used to wedge a demonic foot into the door of your life. Those promoting Christian meditation say that you just focus on scripture while you do it. But that's not where that leads. It ultimately leads you to clearing your mind and then waiting for a special word spoken directly to you. And just FYI, if you're an Enneagram user, I'd suggest you look into it. I'm talking real deep, as it's always been a pagan thing. It's never had a Christian root to it at all. It's demonic to the core. Get the short book, Richard Rohr and the Enneagram Secret. I got the link in the notes. Make sure it's that one, because there's a bunch of them out there, and learn what this thing really is. There's a reason that the Enneagram looks loosely like a satanic pentagram. Just saying. Unfortunately, there are as many Christians as not out there who claim we're supposed to be living in the present, that we're supposed to practice mindful meditation, and they're wrong. An article on whosoever.org has 5 biblical proofs that we are supposed to be present. Now, they'll use verses like found in Matthew 24 about being alert. But that's not being present, because although you're alert at that moment, you're keeping watch for something you're anticipating at some point in the future. They'll try to use the parable of the women in the oil, but the women that brought extra oil had to be thinking of potential future scenarios, like the bridegroom potentially coming later than expected, in order to have enough of that oil. Now, how about Matthew 13:13, which says, quote, seeing they do not perceive, and hearing they do not listen, nor do they understand. See? No? Oh, let's let them explain. Quote, we fear being present because it demands from us that we see, hear, and understand the world going on around us. It requires us to wake from our lazy slumber and stop sleepwalking through our lives. Is it any wonder that people didn't flock to Jesus' message? Being present is a rigorous demand. Still not making sense? Yeah, it doesn't make sense, because this is really stupid. Sorry, I probably shouldn't use that word. This is very stupid. Being present has nothing to do with this verse. Not if you care about context, at least, which seems like less and less Christians are concerned with context. This has to do with Jesus explaining to his disciples why he spoke in parables. This speaks to the sovereignty of God, that not all eyes will be opened. This also fulfills the prophecy in Isaiah. It's a condemnation of those who refuse to see and hear, as well as displaying God's sovereignty in election to salvation. A paradox of free will and God's sovereignty, but not a contradiction. And what it's definitely not is an admonition to them, or you and I, to be present so we can understand the parables. This is some grade A Bible twisting here. In fact, whosoever.org even gives advice from a Buddhist monk in order for us to stay present in the Bible. This is blasphemous. You simply do not twist the word of God like this and expect to be held blameless. Lord, Lord, did we not explain how to practice mindfulness through your word? 26letters.org has, quote, 3 reasons why Christians should live in the moment. Number 1, it helps us appreciate what's given to us. Number 2, it reminds us to make the most of opportunities. And number 3, it means we rest in God. And look, I won't argue with those points. We should be doing those things, but we shouldn't be doing only those things. The problem with Christian mindfulness, or whatever you want to call it, is that depending on the teacher, preacher, organization, influencer, or whoever, they may be innocently speaking of not being anxious for something, or they may be saying to practice some sort of Eastern mysticism jazzed up with a few Bible verses in order to call it Christian. I would say that the smart Christian, whether that's someone providing information or someone receiving information, would stay far away from anything that could be perceived as being Buddhist, thus pagan in origin. Kind of a lipstick on a pig scenario, in my opinion. The Bible is very clear that we are to be anxious for nothing. It's true that we should place all our worries and cares on Christ. It's also true that we should not dwell in the past, whether that's a pet sin that we're reminiscing about, or focusing on past guilt or shame from something we've confessed and been forgiven for, or longing for the past in a way that makes us covet that past. But in no way are we ever to just live in the moment. There is no command that tells us to just live in the moment. Look how many times the Israelites were reminded of where they came from. Moses covered it with them a few times, and that's not counting the entire book of Deuteronomy where he told them absolutely everything again. Joshua did the same thing before he dismissed the tribes into their newly acquired territories. In order for a Jewish boy to be ushered into manhood, he used to have to memorize the Pentateuch, you know, the first five books, or at least he had to study it to a point that he practically memorized it, reminding him of the origin of their people. The reason we have the Bible today is so we can look back, learn from the past, learn our roots and whatever else, and look to the future. This is why we're to meditate on the scriptures, on God's laws and commands. Like I said, we're also supposed to look forward to Christ's return. We're supposed to be prepared. We're supposed to provide for our families and leave an inheritance if at all possible. If we just live in the present moment, we'd never think about any of this, past or future. And that's simply not commanded for us anywhere in the Bible. We're only commanded not to waste time worrying and fretting over the past or the future. There's simply no need to worry. God's in control of everything, whether we perceive it as good or bad at the time. If all we did was focus on the present, when tragedy strikes, when our world falls apart, and they all do from time to time, how could we ever have hope? Our hope is quite literally based in the future. The promise that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to His purpose. Our hope is in the resurrection of Christ in the past, and the promises of our resurrection to life at some point after death in the future. As Paul told the Corinthians, if the dead aren't raised, then even Christ wasn't raised, which makes our faith worthless. We're dead in our sins, and when you die, you're done. Our hope is in vain, and we are of all men most to be pitied. So look, does living in the present create more happiness and satisfaction in this life? Well, if your only alternative is to worry and fret and be anxious or mire yourself in guilt and shame, well, yeah, you'll find the most life satisfaction and happiness by ignoring all of that other stuff and simply focusing on right now. Do genetics play into your ability to live in the present? I'd say probably yes. Your genetics will affect how you process life. That combined with your upbringing, your experiences, your instruction, all of that factors in. Is mindfulness, presence, and meditation the answer to the stresses of life? No, they're a cheap plastic imitation of what we find to be the truth in the scriptures. You know, it would have been interesting to factor in religious beliefs into that study of twins. And maybe they did, I don't know, at least mixed into the social background and the upbringing part. But it would have been interesting to correlate faith, specifically Christian faith, with happiness, or more accurately, joy and life satisfaction. I'd be willing to bet there's a much stronger tie between those than there is with being present. You see, we don't need tricks or attempts to redeem pagan practices in order to find happiness. We just need Jesus. We need His Word, and we need the discipline to not only meditate on the Scriptures, but to apply it to our hearts, minds, and lives. So run from those pushing some form of Eastern mysticism, inside or outside of the church. Don't get taken in by someone just slathering that lipstick on that big old ugly sow, and run to the truth of God's Word, the only place that you can find true peace, joy, hope, and love. Travel back in time with me, won't you? A time of chaos, a time of darkness, a time of death and destruction. Let's set the dials, spin the knobs, press the buttons, flux the capacitors, and 88 the miles per hour, and travel all the way back to what we shall call Event 1. Yes, you guessed it. We're traveling all the way back to March of 2020. This, although not the start, is essentially thought of as the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in the United States. This is when state after state started reporting new cases, an increasing amount of warnings, press conferences, and cancellations rolled out pretty much every day. States started locking down. Toilet paper was nowhere to be found, for some reason that to this day nobody knows why. And then President Trump announced we were going to shut down the country for just 15 days in order to slow the spread. An historic announcement that was grossly inaccurate and, retrospectively, both stupid and pointless. During that time, not only was toilet paper gone, for a virus that wasn't an intestinal type virus at all, but the reality is that when it comes to fear, as we've all discovered, the vast majority of humanity are sheep, or maybe more accurately, lemmings, just following the lemming in front of them off the cliff, or the shopper in front of them to the TP aisle. Okay, funny, and I think possibly tragic story. As you may suspect, I keep up with the news. I heard early on, probably January or February of that year, that this virus was popping up, and for some reason, toilet paper was being bought up like crazy. Now, personally, I try to keep extra supplies of a number of things. Not hoarding, but I like the idea of one in use, one or two on the shelf, right? Toilet paper was no different. One big pack of Charmin Ultra Strong, the only type of toilet paper one should ever purchase, one opened, one big pack on the shelf. When I heard about this happening, I went and bought every pack they had on the shelf. That's not true. I bought one more big pack with the thought that we don't really run through it that fast anyway. Surely I would have enough time to find more as we used it. Anyway, I was in the local Kroger. This was probably in March or April. I was walking down the toilet paper aisle because nobody was there. It was an easy aisle to go down, because the shelves were completely empty. And I happened to overhear one mother speaking to a friend saying that she had been to, and then she listed off about every store in the general region, and she couldn't find toilet paper anywhere. And they were down to their last roll. I legitimately felt bad for her. I really did, but there are such things as tragic comedies, right? I mean, that's what I'd call this. It was funny, but not in a ha-ha sort of way. It was funny, tragic. Anyway, I started by saying that not only was toilet paper gone, and then I had a massive digression, I was going to finish up that statement with, but also were about every disinfecting product you could think of, including hand sanitizer. Now my kid, when she was little, she loved hand sanitizer. I don't know if it was the feel or the smell, but anytime she would see a sanitizer station, which were, it's just kind of set up here or there, it wasn't everywhere you turned, like they are today, she would ask for sanitizer. And most of the time, like a good dad, I would tell her no. See, I come from the generation that was on the tail end of just rubbing some dirt into that big scrape, you'll be fine. Now, some things got cleaned out real well, right? They were scrubbed and Bactined and bandaged. But other things, you'll be fine. You know, bust your knuckles working on something greasy? It'll be fine. Cat tries to claw your face off, even though you're completely innocent and weren't picking on the cat at all. Just quit your crying. You'll be okay. I remember one time many years ago, I plunged a gritty, oily tip of an awl about a quarter of an inch or so into the palm of my hand because I was doing something stupid. I was fine. Now, I don't like hand sanitizer. We are a society that, even prior to COVID, were obsessed and are obsessed with cleanliness. My personal opinion is that we sanitize too much. We wash hands too much. We wipe everything down too much. I don't think we should be filthy people, but there's a large amount of gray area between filthy and what we've become. I have a friend who got in this habit of doing one of those saline nasal cavity rinses every night during a shower. And I told this person that that's not a good idea. The way I understand it, you know, the nose catches all sorts of stuff. Bacteria, viruses, fingers. And my belief, not sure if this is right or not, but my belief is that the body, whether it be inhaling a minor amount into the lungs or ingesting a small amount of these things through drainage into our stomachs, it then uses these minimal ingestions to figure out what exactly might become a problem and creates the immunities, stores that information in our immunity database for later. So I told her this is a bad idea. And then this person started helping their teen child do these every single night. Again, I said this was a bad idea. Stop doing this. Well, after the third trip to the doctor to figure out why this kid was getting sick just over and over, the doctor, after doing some questioning, found out what was going on and said essentially what I said, except more doctorly, of course. You know, stop doing these every day. You're stripping away good bacteria and making the kid more susceptible to illnesses. Well, this is what we're doing, I believe, on a larger scale, by sanitizing, cleaning, washing, and rinsing, and whatever else, absolutely everything. Our systems, personal body systems, are no longer expected to do anything, so when it encounters just basic whatever, it doesn't know what to do with it. According to the CDC, they said that as of 2018, the United States had 2.8 million antibiotic-resistant infections, with over 35,000 of those people dying because of these resistant bacteria. Per an article on microbiologysociety.org, from March 2021, they expressed some concern about the use of hand sanitizers, stressing that at least 20 to 30 seconds of hand cleaning should be done in order to kill the viruses and bacteria. Otherwise, it may just be making them more resistant or stronger. This applies to using other cleaning products by not being thorough or by diluting it beyond how it was intended. You come into the same problem. Now, I'm sure that we're washing hands for 2 minutes and sanitizing for 30 seconds, and I'm sure that we're all thoroughly wiping down every surface rather than just kind of swiping, and we're taking our full course of antibiotics as prescribed, right? But if, and just imagine with me if you will, if we weren't doing that, the concern is that we're just making the genetically stronger bacteria and viruses even stronger. But when the pandemic arrived, more people than I could have ever imagined did things like spray their kids in the face with Lysol. And they mocked President Trump for saying we should inject bleach, which, incidentally, if you believe that, well, you're either a brainless lefty or a mindless drone who just believes what you're told, or you're grossly misinformed. For clarification, Trump, not a medical anything, by the way, was just kind of wondering out loud, which used to be okay, but not anymore. He said this, quote, "And then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see, it gets in the lungs and it does a tremendous number on the lungs. So it'd be interesting to check that, so that you're going to have to use medical doctors with. But it sounds interesting to me. So we'll see. But the whole concept of the light, the way it kills it in 1 minute, that's pretty powerful." Now, he later clarified whatever the heck it was that he just said there when asked about it, quote, "It wouldn't be through injections, almost a cleaning and sterilization of an area. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't work, but it certainly has a big effect if it's on a stationary object." So no, he was wondering if there was some way to kill a virus on contact internally. It's literally a valid brainstorming question, to be honest. Brainstorming used to be a safe thing to do. But what we saw was people spraying their kids in the face with Lysol. We saw people washing and sanitizing groceries, washing and sanitizing food. We saw people wiping down every surface possible, including the steering wheel of the car that they were the only one touching. We had cleaning protocols introduced that were so stringent. I know I personally saw the finish starting to come off of the church pews because they were disinfecting them at least once a week. And hand sanitizer was, and in many cases still is, everywhere. Special tables were set up with sanitizer and instructions to cleanse your hands. People mounted those little pump station things on the walls. Women were carrying it in their purses. Everyone was slathering themselves up with the stuff under the theory that it would save them from the dreaded COVID. Now, hand sanitizer is a pretty simple product. As to who actually invented it originally, there are a few stories. It sounds like the most prominent story is that a nursing student, Lupe Hernandez, invented it in California in 1966. She wanted to make something for doctors to use when they didn't have time to access soap and water in between patients. So she combined alcohol and gel and bada bing, hanitizer. But there is no patent for hand sanitizer with her name attached, so it may or may not be true. A German company, Hartmann, makes their claim to being the first marketable alcohol-based hand disinfectant in 1965. Theirs was a combination of glycerin and 75% alcohol. And then you have, well, kind of a claim from Goldie and Jerry Lipman, a husband and wife team, who developed a waterless cleaner in 1946 made of petroleum jelly, mineral oils, and 5% or less of alcohol. They developed this product in a washing machine tub in their basement, put it in jars, and sold it out of their trunk, primarily to rubber plant workers as an alternative to using kerosene or benzene to remove graphite and carbon black from their hands. And as a former reliability engineer at a tire plant, I can tell you that carbon black gets everywhere, and it's terrible to get off of you. It gets into your pores. Anyway, their product was sold under a combination of their name. They called it Gojo, and every man listening just said, "Ooh." Anyway, fast forward to 1988, and they invented Purell. And all the women listening just said, oh, which is a mixture of 70% ethyl alcohol with propylene glycol and is the world's best-selling hand sanitizer. But it started with Gojo. So, I don't know. Who knows who invented it? But when the pandemic hit, that was one of the things that was going to save society. And then, well, to meet the demand, we kind of needed to get sanitizer from, you know, just anyone, including Mexico and China. And by July 2020, the FDA had 75 different brands on a recall and do not use list. These were sold at your typical locations. No reason to think they were any different than any others, but these contained methanol, commonly called wood alcohol, not ethanol. And although they both sound similar, both smell like alcohol, ethanol is safe to use for sanitizer as well as consumption in alcoholic beverages, and methanol is toxic. So people are lathering up with a toxic substance that could cause blindness or hospitalization through skin absorption and potentially death if ingested. By early August, that list had increased to 149 products, either not using enough alcohol, which makes them useless against viruses, or containing methanol, or now containing 1-propanol, which is a toxin that could affect the nervous system through prolonged exposure. In addition, the FDA came out with some additional warnings. It turns out just because some brands of hand sanitizer were packaged in something that looks like a snack or a drink, that does not actually make them a snack or a drink. Oh, no. So don't drink it. That could be bad. Now, by the end of August, the list now contained over 250 products made in China, South Korea, Guatemala, Poland, Turkey, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, Tennessee, Texas, and Utah. And then fast forwarding all the way to January of 2023, there are, or were, nearly 380 hand sanitizers now listed as do not use. In addition to methanol and 1-propanol, others contained benzene, acetaldehyde, or acetyl, or they were found to contain microbial contamination. That doesn't mean not to sanitize your hands, okay? Clearly, you want to stay sanitized up so you don't die, but just be careful or you might die. So how could this happen? Well, as we know, a pandemic means everything goes, right? Everything is permissible. All regulations are thrown out the window. Even if it kills you, we have to do anything and everything to keep you safe. So in March of 2020, the FDA, quote, temporarily loosened its policies to allow more companies to produce alcohol-based hand sanitizer and related ingredients amid the public health emergency and product shortage. Now, these standards are called CGMP, or Current Good Manufacturing Practices. I've worked in a number of chemical manufacturing plants that sell their products to companies who produce drugs, food, sanitizers, etc., and we must follow CGMP. We're audited stringently on how we follow CGMP. Things like not eating or drinking or chewing gum using tobacco in the manufacturing facility, having a complete paper trail of everything from products that we get in to use to make our chemical to the chemical being shipped to whoever purchases it and everything in between, to seemingly nitpicky things like when correcting a paper record, the incorrect entry is to be crossed out with a single line, not whited out, not scribbled out, not erased, and the correct entry is to be written above with the initials of the person making the correction. My point being, CGMP is a very strict, stringent process that's in place to protect the chemical manufacturer, the final product manufacturer, and the end user. Like all regulating agencies, they may go overboard in some cases, but overall, these are very, very important regulations and processes. But apparently, these standards must be followed unless things get hard or scary. Then the standards can be mostly just tossed out the window. The good thing is that they only did that for over half a year, as they then recalled hundreds of products that could, you know, seriously harm or kill you during that same period of time. Then in October of 2020, they decided that we had enough sanitizer on the shelves, you know, toxic or otherwise, so now the standards are important again. But that was only for the new production. Any sanitizer that was produced during the time when the standards didn't matter, well, that was still fine to sell. Just had to make sure it was sold to the retailers or the wholesalers by March 31st of 2022. Then, of course, the retailers can sell it to you and me at some point after they purchased it from the manufacturer. So potentially harmful sanitizers were being sold to you and me, well, I mean, not me, I don't buy that stuff, for a couple years after it was produced. So that's good, right? In fact, an article on Wired.com from June 2023 stated, quote, 3 years ago, the FDA declared a manufacturing free-for-all. Now a noxious brew of leftover product is catching fire and making people sick. Yeah, see, so we had some fires and explosions at these little pop-up manufacturers. Had chemical smells in various regions from some pretty nasty chemicals. Had side effects and illnesses from personnel and consumer exposure to dangerous versions of alcohols that shouldn't be in sanitizers, all due to the FDA allowing pretty much anyone that could mix an alcohol with a gel and put it in a bottle to do so, and to sell it to whoever would buy it, because it was a matter of life and death due to the virus that we all knew or were told would kill tens of millions of people or more. And now, as of April 2024, we find on sciencealert.com headline, hand sanitizers could damage critical supporting cells in the brain. Okay, I know, pretty late in the segment to be hitting our main article, but I wanted to set the stage because although hand sanitizer uses has undoubtedly decreased since the height of the pandemic, I'd be willing to bet that it's still at a very elevated usage because people are still terrified of viruses and of getting sick from anything for some reason. We seem to have forgotten that people, young and old, male and female, all ethnicities, all countries, get sick from time to time, and for nearly everyone, it'll be fine. We also seem to have forgotten even the basics of our own immune system and how that works. It's not a computer program that downloads updates so that if, you know, something new comes in, it just pulls up the correct recipe file, pulls out the immune system little tiny cauldron, mixes a bit of this, a bit of that, the obligatory Eye of Newt, and Bob's your uncle immunity. No, we actually require an infection of some degree for our system to identify and fight the infecting agent. Even further, we seem to forget that sickness and infection has been going on for either about 6,000 years or twickety bazillion years, depending on if you believe in the actual plausible account of creation or the religious myth of evolution. Either way, even in the flu pandemic that everyone pointed back to, you know, about 100 years ago, humanity didn't die out. We're still here, actually, thriving, in fact. The only thing we know of that nearly destroyed all humanity was the global flood, and that was God directly doing that. But none of that matters, of course. Just slather your hands with alcohol goo and shut up. So one Ms. Erin Cohn, a molecular biologist at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, and her team did some work identifying two major classes of chemicals that, quote, either killed or halted the maturation of cells called oligodendrocytes under laboratory conditions. These cells apparently wrap around neurons, insulating them, which allows the neurons to fire in the brain at the speed that they're supposed to travel, I guess. One such product is called quaternary compounds, which is found in disinfectant sprays and wipes, toothpaste, mouthwashes, and you guessed it, hand sanitizer, in order to kill bacteria and viruses. So as laboratory experiments often do, they used mice, in this case mice pups, and gave them an oral dose of one of three different types of these compounds. Then days later, they tested the brain and found these chemicals in the brain tissue. Now, why is that a big deal? Well, because we never want anything to pass through the blood-brain barrier. That is the thing that is supposed to filter out practically anything and everything from getting to the brain. Except, as it appears, these chemicals, and also the COVID so-called vaccine, which has also been proven to cross that barrier. But that bit of data is much harder to find anywhere. For some reason, I don't know why. I guess it's just a mystery. After 10 daily doses of a specific compound, acetylpyridinium chloride, which is just a fun word to say, but not a fun thing to ingest, they found it had depleted oligodendrocytes in the brain at a key period of brain development, shortly after birth. The data and testing further appeared to show that the oligodendrocytes were specifically affected in the brain by these compounds, but not other brain cells. Now, as these studies typically do, they go to extremes to try to prove a point, right? So the dosages that they gave the mice were multiples more, relatively speaking, than what a human would normally be expected to encounter. So no need to panic yet. That said, they're not saying these compounds aren't toxic, just that they aren't really noticeably toxic at typical levels of contact, inhalation, or ingestion for humans. That said, there are certain professions, think janitorial and or medical, where certain workers are exposed to a much higher level of these compounds than the average person. Furthermore, some recent studies on humans have found that people have about double the level of these compounds in their blood today as opposed to before the pandemic. Now, that will likely put this on the radar, similar to the other kind of toxic compounds she studied, commonly used in things like fire retardants, many of which are being forced to reformulate since these compounds have been found in the blood, urine, placental tissue, and breast milk. And some studies have already shown that children with higher levels of those compounds in their systems were between 2 and 6 times more likely to experience neurodevelopmental issues, such as motor dysfunction and additional educational needs, as opposed to kids with lower levels in their systems. Although the data isn't conclusive right now, the concern is valid, especially since we went absolutely insane about sanitizing and wiping absolutely everything, and we're still sitting at an elevated level of so-called cleanliness because apparently that's the new normal. Ms. Cohn sums this up with, quote, "The developing central nervous system is particularly sensitive to environmental insults, and chemical exposures can be especially harmful to children if they occur during critical periods of development." So, do we have a problem on the horizon? Yeah, I mean, at least potentially. And more data is obviously needed. But if you look at the data for electric vehicles, the latest being that they're literally worse for the environment than internal combustion vehicles, or the data that the global temperature actually hasn't been rising and that storms aren't actually getting worse, or the data that more CO2 in the atmosphere actually makes for a healthier planet, does data really even matter these days? I mean, especially when pitted against my feelings on a subject. If science came out tomorrow with data that said we needed to stop sanitizing everything, including our hands, how would people react? I mean, I think they'd lose their minds. And since our immune systems are all compromised at this point due to the fact that none of us are encountering as many random germs, bacteria, or viruses anymore, and some people are trying to live their lives in some sort of a Lysol fumigated bubble, if we stop sanitizing, there will be a period of time where a lot of people will get very sick. But if we keep doing what we're doing, bacteria and viruses will gain in strength, and that will result in a period of time where a lot of people will get very sick, which will prove that, counter to the data, we must use sanitizer and wipe everything down, you know, just in case. And if that's not working, we must sanitize more and harder, or use less diluted or more harsh chemicals. And pretty soon we're back to a point where the common cold is insurmountable by our atrophied immune system. So look, here's the thing. Obviously, sterilization and disinfecting have their place. Sterilizing instruments and thoroughly washing hands by doctors before, you know, diving into the next surgery victim's body dramatically lowered the death rates due to cross-contamination, for instance. But if you recall, because we have so-called scientists that are either agenda, read that as funding, driven, or they're clueless about what they're talking about, combined with the fact that they look at you and I and bacteria and viruses as all cut from the same evolutionary cloth where literally anything could happen, they actually made the claim when the COVID so-called vaccine was rolling out that we must take the chemical injection because our built-in immune systems were just not going to be able to fight this one off. Well, either they were playing God, which is an odd thing to play when you're talking out of your hindquarters, or they knew something about this definitely naturally occurring species jumping, wet market eating, in no way lab-born, gain-of-function created virus that we didn't know. It turns out they were doing the speaking from the backside thing, as our immune systems actually did the work to quell the lethality of the virus, not the vaccine. It just like has always been done, you know, for all of human history. Funny that. So, why were viruses and bacteria created in the first place? No idea. But since there is no record of God doing any additional creation after he finished on day 6, we know that they were all created in the first 6 days prior to sin. Further, we know that they were created for a purpose, both pre and post fall. Was it the same purpose for both pre and post fall? No idea. But what we do know is that God designed our immune systems to deal with a seemingly infinite number of things that could be thrown at it. Sin has, of course, compromised the system. But even 6,000 years later, and who knows how many copies upon copies upon copies of humans, that system still works nearly perfectly nearly all of the time. It used to be that families would throw chickenpox parties. You know, if my kid got it, send yours over, let him or her get it, and let's just get them all out of the way. Now, was that the right thing to do? I don't know. Maybe. But now, if little Johnny has a sniffle, keep him home for 37 days. We don't want to get other kids sick. And little Mary is now just a pincushion with vaccines, so-called, for everything under the eclipsing or non-eclipsing sun. And if cleanliness is next to godliness, at this point, there are some people that are literally sitting on the arm of God's heavenly throne, kind of just one cheek in it there, as they slowly slide down in and snuggle onto the nice cushy seat, you know, nuzzled into the arm of God himself, so to speak. God created us with amazing abilities. How different would this pandemic have looked if we as a global citizenry believed that? How different would we treat basic aspects of life if we understood that? How much real science could we really do? And how many amazing discoveries could we discover if we started with the truth of God's word? And how should we do this today? How should we look at our systems and what the world is telling us to do and what we actually do today? But that's just being silly, right? Science, that's where it's at. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to go hanitize. Hey, y'all. So have y'all been Bereans since last week? How about reading? Are you reading something? It's been, 5 weeks since we talked about books? What with the Easter break and all? So have you been pounding through the books? And we're talking physical books, which always feel and smell better, in my opinion, or e-books, which our government will one day edit and or take away, you know, per 1984, or audiobooks, you know, just let someone else do all the word reading, you do all the word listening. Now, I'm a physical book guy myself. I think I've got a couple e-books, if they're actually still active and available to me, and I've got a few free books I was able to download as PDF documents. Don't think I've ever read them. And I don't think I've ever listened to an audiobook, now that I think about it. I mean, nothing wrong with them. They can actually be fun, especially if it's the author that's reading his or her book. I just don't think I've ever listened to one. Anyway, welcome back to Danny's Book Review, installment number 3. So as of today, I'm sitting at right about 2,000 pages read for the year. This isn't a goal update, obviously, but that's nearly halfway to my goal for 2024. I guess probably around, 45% of my goal, and only like 30% of the way through the year. So that's good. Now, this update only has 2 books to review, which, to be honest, that's probably a realistic number of books to finish and review every month, unless I, you know, end up pulling Atlas Shrugged off the shelf, which has been staring at me for a number of years now. That sucker has like 20,000 pages. She's a big book. Let's just say that. Okay, anyway, let's get to it. The first book on the shelf is the latest offering by Richard Paul Evans in the Michael Vay series. If you've been following my podcast for a while now, you've potentially heard me talk about this series once or twice before. It's a young adult fiction, action, science fiction, thriller kind of book. It's got kind of a little bit of all these genres mixed in there. But really, don't most books, really? I mean, this one's entitled The Traitor. It's book number 9 in the series. This series was originally slated for 7 books, which he wrote from 2011 to 2017, at which point he wrapped it up. But then in 2022, he came out with book number 8. Book 9 was at the end of last year. Book 10 has a tentative release date of the end of 2024. Now, Evans is a Mormon, which is a term we're not supposed to use anymore, but I openly refuse to use the much longer, much too long of a name that they would prefer we use. So, Mormon it is. And although Mormons are not Christians, because they simply don't believe in the Bible or the same Jesus that the Bible clearly talks about, they do have Christian morals, and in some cases, better than your run-of-the-mill Christians, which should really kind of speak to all of us. So that being the case, these books are solid reads for just about any age. Now, there are some scary or emotional parts. These may not be good for really little kids, but they're great for the vast majority of people. The basic premise of these books revolves around a group of teens who, due to being part of an experimentation thing with fetal development, etc., etc., they possess special powers. Most of them join up and form the Electro Clan. And of course, there are bad guys and good guys and twists and turns throughout the stories. I don't really want to go any deeper than that. I don't want to give any spoilers. I don't want to ruin it. Now, this specific book, The Traitor, once again, excellently written. It's fast-paced, attention-grabbing, and it's just kind of a fun, quick read. Some parts are fairly predictable. Other parts contain twists you would have never expected. Each book has a section at the beginning with a dossier of the main characters. But it would be really difficult to pick up this book just on its own, or really any book in the series, and just start reading if you haven't read the previous books. There's a lot of background that you really kind of need for these to make sense. So, my recommendation is that you start with book number one, entitled The Prisoner of Cell 25, and work your way through the series. Once you start reading, the odds are you won't want to put it down, and as fast as they go, you could probably knock out the 300-ish pages in each book in a day if you really wanted to. So, as expected, I'd highly recommend these books. They're what I like to call palate cleansers. If you read a lot of nonfiction, political, religion, self-help, etc., these kinds of books can really help keep you from getting just drained. If you haven't started the Michael Bay series, I'd recommend you do it. I don't think you'll regret it. Speaking of draining books, moving to book number two for this review, The Great Reset by one Glenn Beck. Now, you may love or hate Glenn Beck. I've been listening to him and reading most of his books for, I don't know, it's like the last 16 years, maybe. And he's been, he's been very right about a lot of things. And he's exposed a lot of things just over and over again. Now, Glenn is also a Mormon. In fact, it's his publishing company who publishes the Michael Bay books. Because them Mormons, they like to stick together, don't you know? So Glenn is also not a Christian. And I've cautioned people to take what he says regarding religion and faith with a very large, discerning grain of salt. And lately, he's really started diving into signs of the end times and things like that with some of the so-called prophets and charlatans of the heretic wing of Christianity. He's desperately trying to figure out what's going on in this world from a spiritual standpoint, but his understanding is so contorted and twisted because he believes a lot of lies that are mixed into and thus redefine the actual truth. I've done a lot of eye-rolling in his podcast lately, and I'll tell you what, it confuses me how he can be someone who does so much in-depth research and yet just accepts the premise of the Mormon religion on its face. Anyway, few areas he's looked at recently, just to give you an idea, and just, I guess, to kind of allow me to vent to someone, is one of them is covenants. A few months ago, he went through a process of writing a new covenant that we, Americans, could make with God. He had a full-blown 40-day devotional that was supposed to precede it because, you know, 40 days. And then he had people repeat after him reading the covenant. And the problem is, we don't covenant with God because we can't keep it. God covenants with man. Now, I didn't go back to look at every instance in the Bible, but I think in every case in the Bible, when there's a covenant between God and man, God initiates it, God ratifies it, God sets the terms, and God keeps it. Anytime that man has agreed to God's covenant, he's failed. Man has failed. Let me be very clear here. But Glenn, trying to save the soul of America, believes that the verse, quote, "If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and I will heal their land." He believes that verse is for us, or it can be used for us. That verse isn't for us, at least not in context. Now, can we or should we actually do that? And I would say yes, repenting, turning from wickedness, seeking God's face, yes, we should do that. There's no question there. Can God heal our land? Absolutely. He could. He might even. But that verse was never meant to, you know, just apply to whoever says it. He also recently had on Hugh Ross, a man who professes to be a Christian, but he absolutely does not believe the Bible is written. At least, at least not the beginning, and not a lot of parts throughout the Bible. He's an evolutionary astrophysicist who has just violently ripped verses out of context, reinterpreted them in their English forms to make them mean things they were never meant to mean in order to prove that evolution is true. And even with that, he's got a very odd view of evolution as well, to be honest. But Glenn, who believes in a basically infinite timeline of gods and creations, etc., with our God being one of the many gods who was simply a creation of a different God, you know, created as a mortal being, but by being faithful was granted God's status and given his own ability to create his own creation. And if we're faithful, one day we too could become gods and lord over our own creations. Only if you're Mormon, though. Because Glenn doesn't believe the Bible is written, he absolutely grabbed on hook, line, and sinker to the evolutionary long age earth tripe that Hugh Ross was feeding him. And then most recently, Glenn has been trying to tie recent events in Israel with the eclipse, etc., etc., to point to the end, you know, probably coming soon. But of course, the end according to him is not the same as the end according to the Bible as a Christian. Anyway, my point is that when it comes to religion, either tune them out, skip past that section, or turn your discernment up to about 11 out of 10. He's well-intentioned, I'll give him that. He does get a few things right, but boy, he's got a lot of that stuff wrong. That said, with regard to politics, the economy, world events, you know, the human world, he's usually spot on. Now, he's been wrong on some things, and some things I thought were just kind of obvious, but he went down a path anyway. But overall, I believe him to be a very solid purveyor of information with regard to our human existence. And in some ways, and don't take this the wrong way, I look at him as kind of a modern-day prophet regarding our man-made systems. Okay, this book, The Great Reset, wasn't intended to be, but turned out to be book one of at least a two-book series and likely more. The subtitle is Joe Biden and the Rise of the 21st Century Fascism. The book came out in 2022. I pre-ordered it, received it either the day or the day before it released to the public. That was in early January of 2022. And for over 2 years now, it's been sitting on my nightstand just staring at me. And every time I was ready to start the next book, I'd look at it and I'd say, oh, I can't do that one right now. Beck is a fantastic author. Well, Beck and his co-writers, his editors, etc., you know, his team, they deliver excellent books. Let's just say that. But the content in this one is pretty heavy. So this book discusses the impact the COVID pandemic had on the global order and what the general response and compliance of the public taught the global elites. Think of the World Economic Forum, for instance. He goes on to address climate change and what's really intended with the push to go so green that we eliminate all CO2 from the atmosphere, destroy all the green through suffocation. That's how green we want to go. He talks about modern monetary theory. And yes, I know you're on the edge of your seat right now. This is the idea that unlimited borrowing and infinite debt by a nation's government isn't really a big deal, which is why we're now adding $1 trillion of debt every 100 days. And then he moves into the Great Reset. Now, you've possibly, maybe even likely heard that term over the last few years, or you've heard someone say that what the world needs is a reset or a great reset, something like that. This great reset isn't like turning your computer off and back on again, you know, just to clear things up and clean things out, make it run better and faster. This is the equivalent of adding a very, very malicious virus to your computer, causing it to slow down and give all your banking information to someone, and then of course it'll start smoking, then light on fire, burning the house down, destroying everything you cherish. But don't worry about it, you'll be dead. These aren't conspiracy theories. I mean, they would likely be termed that way, but they are in fact verifiable, credible, and noted sources, including from the WEF itself. There are very powerful, very rich, and in most cases, very old people who are working every day to figure out how to bring the entire world into subjection under their rules. It's quite nefarious, to be honest. So, do I recommend this book? Well, not to everyone. There are some people that, for whatever reason, could not handle reading this book. I'm probably on the edge of that, you know, right in the gray middle somewhere. Although Glenn gives potential solutions or mitigations to fight against this plan by the global elites, this book can easily make you enraged or terrified or depressed, or maybe just a fun potpourri consisting of all those emotions and some others. What it won't do is make you happy. Now, you may feel some hope at the end of the book, but that hope will be caveated with, you know, if we do this or if we wake up in time. So it's a very shallow hope at best. But I'm also a firm believer that we must stay informed. Look, I can handle reading this book, I believe, because I know that God is sovereign. I know that all things are under God's control because he ordained all things before creating the first molecule. But I don't see how that absolves you and I from our responsibilities on Earth. For most of us, this will be an informational book only. This gives us things to look for, to watch out for. It gives us justification and backing for our beliefs about certain issues, etc., etc. For some, this would spur them on to get into the politics game and strive to make a legislative difference. So overall, I would recommend this book based on the content, based on the information, based on the time we're living in, which is really, I mean, we're 3 years past when this book was written, and nothing has changed or gotten better since that book was written. I would not recommend this book for those who can't handle it. And again, you know who you are. If all this book will do is depress or enrage you, don't read it. Go read Michael Vay. Okay, well, as before, those are Danny's book reviews. This time, for installment number 3. Next time, I don't know, we'll see. Should be one or two books. As always, we'll see how it goes. What I can tell you is that the next two books, kind of along the same lines as The Great Reset. They're both difficult, current topic-related books, but concluding with varying degrees of hope. As always, I put the Amazon links in the notes, which doesn't mean or even imply that you have to buy from Amazon. It's just the easiest place to link to, and that'll do it for now. So now, go read something. And with that, sadly, we've reached the end of yet another episode of the Logical Christian Podcast. I feel we've bonded as we've laughed and cried and twisted our faces in incredulity. If you've enjoyed or found value in what you've heard, go on and do all the podcast things. And don't forget to check the show notes for links and contact info. Lawrence J. Peter said, "Against logic, there is no armor like ignorance. Jesus told us that if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So stay in the word, stay logical, stay faithful, and until next time, God bless.